This is episode 403, dated Monday, August 11th, 2025.
You are listening to Sports Roundtable.
Hi, everyone. Welcome once again to Sports Roundtable. I am Bob Branco. Glad to be with all of you on this fine day. This is episode 403, dated Monday, August 11th, 2025. Before we continue with our multitude of sports and possibly a special guest, let me introduce the panel members that we have so far. We start out with Don Wardlow.
Say, Bob and Mitch and Reverend, how you everybody doing? Here in Jersey, it's again back up between 85 and 90.
We're close to 90 here. It's been hot, a little bit on the humid side. We're going to have a little mini heat wave for the next two or three days, but then it should clear up after that. Mitch Pomerantz.
Good afternoon, good evening from beautiful downtown Pasadena, where it is 86 and sunny and supposed to be going up to 91. Thank goodness our HVAC system is good and only a couple of years old, because otherwise we'd be sweltering. But things are going well, and good to be here. Wasn't sure I was going to make it, but enjoy the show and enjoy participating.
Reverend Michael Garrett.
Well, yes, and welcome to from 93 degrees and sunny and hot, sweltering, Missouri City, Texas. I'm glad you're here. Just had a birthday over the weekend and had a great time. So,
but it's happy birthday!
Here today. Thank you.
You're welcome. We are still waiting on Peter Altschul and Luther King, but I'm sure that when they do arrive, they will let us know. In the meantime, let me thank those people who make it possible for Sports Roundtable to be made available. We start out with Raymond Gay, our producer and editor. Thank you for what you do. Also, the media outlets that we have. Thank you. We have it's a returning media outlet. They took a sabbatical for a while, but technical reasons. And that would be Blue Streak Radio. We welcome them back into the fold. Okay, I want to thank Jenna publicly for airing Sports Roundtable again. It's much appreciated. I also want to thank Jacqueline Sylvia from JS Web Solutions for archiving our shows on my website. In order for you to find those archives, go to www.brancoevents.com. Arrow down until you get to Sports Roundtable Podcasts. Click on them, and you will see most of our archived programs, from latest to earliest, of course. And merci, Jackie. I've got a villain for Peter when I say that. I want to say hi to Trish, our facilitator for today's program, along with Brad, who is our streamer. And because we are streamed live, I want to give out my email address for those people who would like to write to us. We always want to hear from fans, so I encourage you, if you are listening, if you have thoughts about our show, comments about what we talk about, please let us know by emailing bobbranco93@gmail.com. That's bobbranco93@gmail.com. As I said a little while ago, we may have a special guest. I'm not sure if he's arrived or not.
He's here. David is here.
Okay. David Shoemate is here. He's been on the show before. He is the voice of the Duke Blue Devils. David, it's a pleasure to have you back. I understand you'll be with us for about a half an hour.
That's great. Thanks for having me on. I feel like I should give the weather here in Durham. It's 80 degrees and humid with some thunderstorms hanging around, but not too bad for this time of year.
All right. So you're preparing for the football season, I imagine.
Absolutely. And we're looking forward to what should be a really good football season. Manny Diaz is the head coach here at Duke going into his second season. Obviously, a long time known name in the college football world, was defensive coordinator at Penn State for a couple of years before that. And then obviously spent some time at Miami as the head coach, had a really good year last year and a lot of returning pieces, particularly on a defense that was elite, and creating tackles for loss and sacks and bringing in a new quarterback that comes over from Tulane and Darian Mensah. So there's a lot to be excited about and some really good games at the outset. Duke opens with Elon on a Thursday night. And then a week later, AP poll just came out today. Illinois is number 12 in the preseason AP poll. They're going to be coming to Durham week two. So very exciting start to the season. We're definitely ready to get going.
I can't believe we're talking about college football already. Where does the time go, David? I'm telling you, it's unbelievable.
No, it feels like we were just in San Antonio in the Final Four with John Shire's group. And now here we go with football again, and basketball will be going before we get too far down the road. But it's been a good summer, and now we're ready to get after it again.
David, you may find this interesting. I'm a collector of old sports broadcasts, mostly baseball, but I have some football and some basketball. The oldest that I know of recording of a college football game featured the Duke Blue Devils. It was the 1939 Rose Bowl. They were playing the USC Trojans out in Pasadena. There is, to my knowledge, there's no recorded college football game older than that one.
That's incredible. And obviously there's some history with Duke and the Rose Bowl in the 40s when obviously war broke out. Wallace Wade Stadium, our home football stadium, actually hosted a Rose Bowl during that time period. So that's awesome, though, that you have the tape going all the way back to 39.
I did not know they hosted it that one year during the war. That is fascinating.
Yep, a little bit of Rose Bowl history for you, though. That's probably the extent of my Rose Bowl history knowledge. But there you go, a little food for thought.
Well, Dave, this is Mitch from Pasadena. If you ever come out to Pasadena, and you can get in touch with me. I have a dear friend in our local Lions club, and Tom gives tours of the Rose Bowl. Michael Garrett and I did a tour with him several years ago, and he and his wife were out visiting. And Tom is extremely knowledgeable about the history of the Rose Bowl. It's not a place where I would necessarily want to go back to another game. I went a few years ago and sat so high up. I was sitting in the USC rooting section because I'm a Trojan, but we sat so high up that A, we couldn't hear the band, and B, it was too far to walk to get a beer. But if you ever want to take a tour, of the Rose Bowl, you come out here, get in touch with me through Bob and give me a holler.
No, I would love that. I actually have one of my sisters lives out in Los Angeles, been out there a couple of times, haven't been to Pasadena to see the Rose Bowl, but obviously that scene and when the sun is setting, when the Rose Bowl is being played is just iconic. As you said, it seems like a gigantic building, but no, it's just one of the iconic places.
David,
it's a great tour, and you get to see some interesting things because going to the locker room, going to the press box, all that. Tom does a great job with the tour.
That's awesome.
David, one of the latest trends in college football that people are conversing about quite a lot, and I'm sure you have some thoughts on this, is about the money that's being paid to the college athletes now more than ever. And it seems to be a focus now for college athletes to get this handsome pay. What are your thoughts on this latest trend, and where do you think this is going to go?
Yeah, I mean, I think, and you guys, I would imagine, have discussed this at length. It's kind of gone through several iterations, even in the last handful of years, when the initial legislation that came out, there was a court case that dealt with how much schools could directly compensate athletes for their academic endeavors, and the Supreme Court ruling came out 9-0, and that spawned some internal reforms with the NCAA. I'm kind of condensing a few things down into one that allowed for student athletes to monetize off of their name, image, and likeness. And that kind of opened up some opportunities through corporate endorsements, but also spawned in the industry what are widely known as collectives, that were taking in donor money and corporate dollars and, you know, distributing them to student athletes in the form of NIL agreements that some people thought was more direct compensation in terms of their performance on the field. So, and most recently through a settlement, the House settlement that just got approved this past summer, they've allowed now for schools to directly compensate student athletes, in the form of up to $20.5 million, I think is the number, amongst all the different sports that the school sponsor. And they're kind of vetting that out now. of how you want to split that between different sports, and each school has a different philosophy with that, and each level, right, of Power Four conferences, of which Duke is a part of, Group of Six conferences, and on down the line. So to me, I mean, broadly, what I think about it is it's a great opportunity for the student athletes to be able to make that income while they're in school and have that opportunity to share in the revenue that is generated for college sports. I think there's a lot to be sorted out in terms of enforcement for, you know, universities or whomever that might want to exceed that cap or not follow the rules appropriately in terms of name, image, and likeness. And I think that's kind of being worked out. Anything new is going to have some bumps that go along with that. And I do think the other thing that I think is important in this is it's college sports, and maybe I'm a traditionalist, but emphasis on college there. And I don't think we want to get lost how important the educational opportunity is for these student athletes, because the vast majority of them, more than 90%, will never go pro. And I think the ability to get a degree and set the foundation for your career while you're playing sports and have the opportunity to monetize things while you're playing sports is good. So to me, I hope this works, and I think it will work. And I hope within that, maybe we get some reforms associated with the transfer portal just to make the educational opportunities a little steady. So it's a very long-winded answer. So as you can probably tell, kind of a complex topic right now.
Well,
Dave,
Has Duke been affected by the transfer portal? You know, as all schools are, there are like 2,000 guys in the transfer portal. So I'm sure that Duke's been touched by it, but has it been significant?
Not to the degree that other schools have. And I think that a big piece of that is obviously the value that comes with having a Duke degree, and being able to do that. So Duke hasn't seen as many guys transfer out. Had a handful of guys transfer in with football, men's basketball, women's basketball, on down the line, people come in to see that opportunity. So it's not like Duke is not participating in the transfer portal at all, but I don't think you've seen the mass exodus that you've seen in some other places. Even when there have been coaching changes on the football side, Duke hasn't seen that. I think that's because of the value of the degree and the opportunity to be at Duke. And I want to clarify what I was saying of, like, to me, it's in the interest of the student athletes to be at a certain school, but also understand that, like, if you're not playing sports, you can change colleges every year if you want to, if you can meet admissions requirements. So I think there's something to be said there that student athletes have the right to do what's right for them in a given set of circumstances. But I do think for anyone that's, you know, spent their time at a four-year institution getting a degree, I think everyone can kind of speak to the value of being in one place and what you get there educationally. So that to me is the only kind of quirk that I hope we kind of keep front and center as we do this, is making sure the education piece of it is still a huge part of it.
Well, education first.
There's another issue though that I think is just as concerning. The money haves, and I went to USC and we're a money have, as opposed to the money have nots. And while it might be great for the student athletes, I think NIL and the transfer portal is going to further broaden the gap between the haves and the have nots, that the SEC schools, the ACC schools, the Big Ten schools, they'll do just fine. But, you know, in college basketball, the mid-majors, for example, I really think this is going to change particularly college basketball and football to the point where instead of 120-some-odd schools in the top tier in football and 300 in the top tier in college basketball, I think that number is gonna get much smaller over the next decade, because the mid majors in basketball and the smaller, less well funded schools in college football, they just can't afford this.
Yeah, I mean, I think that's a fair concern, and that it's kind of one of the, there's a million unknowns, honestly, as we go into this, that what are the downstream effects? And I think what you articulated there is fair. I just think there's an unknown of what's going to happen in this. And I think the flexibility is going to be needed to adjust on the fly to those needs of, you want to obviously create these opportunities for student athletes and opportunities they've earned through their play, but also opportunities they've earned in terms of building their own brand on social media. when you get into the NIL side of it and different avenues they have, but also at the same token, like you said, some degree of competitive balance and having a lot of schools be able to participate in the system is a huge piece of it. And like I said, I think what you're saying is fair. I just think it's kind of an unknown because those competitive imbalances and resources have always been there in some respects. They just manifested themselves in different ways. And the latest is the student athletes being paid directly. And I think it's fair to be concerned, but also kind of just go in with eyes wide open that this is going to look different and be able to adjust if it becomes a challenge.
I'd like to think it'll be better than the guys getting paid under the table. If you read the works of Dan Jenkins in some of his novels, some of his peripheral characters were college footballers who were being paid under the table, and it was in like an open secret. And there's not only that, there were the no-show classes, the cheating scandals that have happened over the decades. Hopefully with NIL and the money being paid out, hopefully, you know, that stuff is going to go away.
Yeah. I mean, I think that's a fair thought of this too, of bringing some of it out into the open, I think is what you're talking about in terms of compensating student athletes. And hopefully some of that stuff that's referenced wasn't too broad, but happened in the past, and it can be more of a above board system, so to speak. And another thing that I don't want to get lost in this too, I mean, but the U.S. is going to host the next Summer Olympics. Obviously the Winter Olympics are coming up, that those opportunities for sports that are not traditionally revenue generating sports, that there's some way to maintain those opportunities as well, because to me, they enrich the campus life experience, but also in terms of the U.S. being competitive in the Olympics, I think that's a big piece of it as well. So how do we maintain some of that as well, even in sports that are not traditionally revenue generating, as you look at football, men's and women's basketball and those sports? It's a lot to sort out for senior leaders, both in conferences and athletic directors' offices and presidents, to try to strike that balance of fairness in terms of student athletes and what they've earned and what they've generated in terms of revenue dollars, but also maintaining some of those opportunities, like I said, for the sports that historically have not been revenue generating.
I'm looking at a school like SMU, who's the only school that has gotten the death penalty. But now they seem to be gaining momentum. I look at their recruiting athletes, and they have gotten some very good athletes, and even in football and basketball, and they're producing some of those athletes that go to the pros, and apparently they have a little money too.
Yeah, and there's plenty of schools like that. I mean, I think SMU famously, when they joined the ACC a year ago, for the tenure of the television agreement, are not taking a distribution like the other schools are. So they've been able to, through donors or what have you, find other revenue streams that obviously can supplant that money they're losing on the television side. And as you said, obviously that is born into other areas. That's allowed them to have the same talent, if not elite talent, that schools in the ACC have, getting to Charlotte in the ACC title game in their first season. So that's the thing about this. We're trying to build a system that works for everybody, but there's a lot of different folks and a lot of different sets of circumstances all across the country. So, and I think that's one of the reasons the conference commissioners and the NCAA have asked for national legislation to give some guidance and how to handle these sorts of things, because in many respects, while each campus has its own issues, each conference has its own issues, a lot of these issues have national ramifications, and we may need Congress ultimately to kind of lay the groundwork for what the rules of the road are, so to speak. But that's obviously for people way above me to sort out.
David, do you anticipate, because I've been hearing this for a while now, changes in the college playoff format? Is it going to resemble the NCAA eventually, or something along those lines? I don't mean to that extreme, but I've been hearing different things that might be happening down the road.
Yeah, I think it's right now it's in a little bit of a state of flux, right? Because of the current model that is a 12-team playoff with the automatic bids and then the at-large selections. And there's been some conversations over the summer and different opinions and thoughts about what a new structure would look like, both in terms of who has access, but also what the format would be. and the way that the legislation is written or the way the agreement has been made amongst the Power Four conferences, while the ACC and the Big 12, from everything I understand, has input, it's ultimately up to the SEC and the Big 10 to decide on the format, and they don't agree right now. The SEC is more into line of a 5+11 model if it goes to 16, which means the five highest ranked conference champions get an automatic bid and then 11 at-large selections, versus the Big 10 is advocating for more of a certain number of bids by conference. And there's been a bunch of different reporting about that. But I do think as we move forward, the history of playoffs against, if you look at professional sports, you look at collegiate sports, they get bigger, they don't get smaller. So I do think it will get bigger at some point. How long it takes to get there, how many that ultimately ends up being, to me, that's a little bit of an open question. Obviously, the bowl system is very important in college football, and keeping that around and giving those opportunities to student athletes, I think, is still important. But I do think the playoff will grow. I don't know where it'll ultimately settle, but I would be surprised if in the next 5, 10, 15 years, it certainly doesn't have more members into the playoffs.
One of the things that is an unintended or perhaps intended consequence, and maybe it's because of our coach. I am not a Lincoln Riley fan, but there has been talk about no longer scheduling Notre Dame. He is playing. Our first two games are against a couple of, I wouldn't even glorify them by calling them cupcakes. we are, and I've heard this from others, that in order to have a shot at the playoffs, teams may stop scheduling those intersectional rivalries with teams that are pretty decent. It would be a crime if USC didn't play Notre Dame. My fervent hope, as I've said on this program before a couple of times, is that somebody in the NFL decides to take Lincoln Riley away from us so we can hire a real coach who knows what he's doing. But in the interim, given his buyout, he's not going anywhere. But I'm real concerned about an expanded playoff. Even the playoffs that we've got now are getting teams to not schedule teams outside of their conference that have any chance of winning.
Well, and I think what you're speaking about, and I kind of mentioned that there's some philosophical differences between the SEC and the Big Ten now, the two highest ranked leagues in terms of preseason rankings and things like that, is the number of conference games you play. Right now, the Big Ten plays 9, the SEC plays 8, but also how the committee evaluates different teams and their different schools of thought. And the committee changes year to year, right? So what is the metrics they're using to evaluate teams? Right now, they don't have any hard and fast rules outside of the five conference, highest ranked conference champions get an automatic bid. Everything else is subjective. And there's some in the school of thought that, you, as you said, are affected scheduling, that the number of wins you have is most important in a 12 game season, that if you have 11 wins or 12 wins, it's not as important against who. And in the instance of USC, when you're playing 9 league games, there's a theory of like those non-conference games outside of that can only hurt you in some respects because you have such a difficult schedule internally, versus some that believe the strength of the conference and the strength of your record should matter more, and the quality of the competition, how you evaluate that. And college sports has seen so many iterations of this over the years, right? I mean, when there was first a clamor to have a national championship game, the computers generated it. There was the BCS model where the computer spit out who the top two teams were. And there was a formula, and people didn't like that. They wanted more of a subjective quality. So when the playoff came around, we went back to a committee, and it wouldn't shock me if down the road, whether AI is involved or different specific analytics, now that more teams are getting into the playoff, that we go more to a metrics-based system so that coaches know going in what they need to do to have access. It's no different than the, you know, NCAA tournament and the net ranking, which is the primary ranking tool for men's college basketball, women's college basketball, that coaches definitely look at that in terms of how they want to schedule in terms of getting into the tournament. So to me, that's not unusual. And that's just a part of when you have a playoff and the emphasis becomes on winning the national championship and getting into the playoff, you do lose some things in terms of rivalries, particularly if they aren't within your conference. And I do think that's going to be something we see more of. Is not, some people say you're gaming the system. I don't agree with that. You're trying to figure out what works best for your fan base in terms of what you need to do and your institution to get to the playoff. Because if you get to the playoff, that's a successful season. But college sports is in a tricky situation because of the historic nature of not really having a lengthy postseason, really just one game, or now we have two or three that set up the postseason for the national champion, is the value of these regular season games, which created the import, these almost like special events, because there are only 12 of them during the regular season, and you don't want to lose that either. So there's this push and pull. You can tell as people are trying to evaluate the system that what's going to work best, but by the same token, from a head coach's seat, you're going to be judged on making the playoffs, so I understand what their perspective is too. It just is a lot of different things. And I think there's a little bit lack of clarity right now where we're headed, both in terms of the structure of the playoff, but also how teams are being evaluated in terms of ultimately getting into it. And the people that are deciding that, the commissioners of the different conferences, are obviously lobbying for their respective conferences. And I think that's why there's been such a hard time finding consensus.
David, I know you have to go momentarily. I did want to see if I can get a member of our audience to come in and ask you a question, I'm sure, before you leave, if that's permissible to you and to the rest of the panel members, because we do have people out there who know you're on and somebody may want to ask you something. Let me just ask Trish if there are any hands raised.
Oh, let's see. I don't see any right at the second.
That's okay. I just wanted to give everybody that opportunity before David had to leave.
Nope, no hands at the moment.
All right. Okay. Anybody else with a question on the panel?
Well, I want to follow up to what Dave said, because in college basketball, and I forget the term, but they do have a ranking system, and I don't mean 1 through 25, but they say it's a Schedule 1 team or a Schedule 2 team, and as I said, I don't remember what they call it, but there's more weight if you beat a particular team as opposed to another team. Something like that, I suppose, could happen in college football, couldn't it?
Yep, and that was what I was referencing with the net ranking is what they call it. And based on what your net ranking is, the wins and losses, so to speak, get put into four quadrants, quadrant 1, quadrant 2, quadrant 3, and quadrant 4. And that's also based off of where the game was played, right? Were you at home? Were you on the road? Was it on a neutral floor? For an example, like a quad 1 win, you'd be playing an opponent that's in the top 30 nationally in the net rankings at home. On a neutral floor, it's 1 through 50. On the road, I believe it's 1 through 75. And you can go on down the list. And the other thing about that you have to kind of balance, and it makes sense as the season moves along, those rankings are fluid, right? So if someone's ranked 28th when you play them at home and you beat them, yes, that's a quadrant 1 win. But if they drop as the year moves along, that no longer is a quadrant 1 win for you. It's kind of a freeze frame at any given moment, but also at the end of the year. And I could definitely see football going to something like that so that people can see where they are and where these wins matter to have a primary ranking tool. It's also worth noting, while the college basketball committee relies on that heavily, that's just a tool, right? That's not determinative for their selections, but they definitely give a lot of weight to it. I saw maybe Rick has a question, so I don't want to go on too long if you wanted to ask something.
Yeah, Rick does have his hand up. Go ahead, Rick.
Welcome, Rick.
Okay, thank you. Thank you. I've got kind of a couple of things. The first thing is, if you did add a playoff system, I think it'd be terrific. I think part of the problem now is there are way too many bowl games. I mean, every time you turn around, there's a bowl game, and some of these bowl games are kind of ridiculous. I mean, here in Florida, we had, I think it was last year, I think it was called the Boca Raton Bowl game or something. It was kind of ridiculous.
Yeah, I mean, I totally understand the perspective. The only kind of counterpoint I may have to that is, well, there's two things really, that the bowls, for whatever people might think about some of the names and things like that, and maybe the competitive nature of them, they rate really well on television. They're good programming for ESPN, and particularly ESPN, but Fox has a little bit of it too. Around the holidays, people watch those football games for a myriad of different reasons. And also, as someone who covers a team and works with the team day in and day out, I think about, you know, Duke played Central Florida in the Military Bowl a couple years ago, which isn't a marquee bowl, probably somewhere in the middle tier, but to be with those student athletes and see how much they enjoyed the experience and the opportunity, especially for the older guys who aren't going professional and that's the end of their career, to have one more chance to go and play together, they got a lot out of it and the turnout was good. So I can see both sides of that. Some people think the bowl games are silly, particularly with the transfer portal, which I do think there is some movement with the transfer portal. There's a window where team or student athletes can transfer. That actually happens before the bowl games, which has caused some problems. I think there's some movement to move it after the bowl games, which I think would help to some extent. But I do think there's a bunch of different ways you could look at the bowl system and expanding the playoff. At some point, the bowl system becomes untenable, but I've also seen student athletes have really good experience at those bowls as well, and I don't want that to be discounted.
But a lot of those bowl games are just so people can bet on them, which really, really gets my goat.
Yeah, I agree. Anything else, Rick?
No, Bob. Right now, I think that's it. I got a couple of baseball things if we get to them later. So.
All right, we'll stand by and we will may get to it. David, let us know how long you need to stay or how long you know, when you need to leave so that we can have an idea.
You I just need to go know. In the next 5 minutes or so.
All right. Okay.
Yep.
Well, thank you, Rick.
Okay. Thank you, Bob.
Trish, do we have anybody else waiting in the wings for David?
We do not.
Okay.
David, quickly, I listen to Chris Edwards when he does the women's games. Did you ever get to work with Bob Harris, who used to do the men's game, the legend, the icon at Duke?
I got to know Bob in his last year. Maybe the last 2 years, I should say. I had a chance to fill in a few times when he had football and men's basketball conflicts and had a chance to pick his brain and get some advice. And then when I was fortunate enough to follow Bob, I had a chance to spend some time with him and get some advice from him about how to kind of proceed into the role. And obviously, it's impossible to follow a legend like Bob and everything he's meant to Duke, but also to broadcasters in general, and just such a kind man that obviously we lost last summer. But had definitely had a chance to get to know him and get to know he and his wife Phyllis in my time here at Duke, and couldn't be more thankful for that. And as you mentioned, we've got a lot of good broadcasters around here, and Chris is certainly chief among that with what he does with our women's basketball programs and also with our baseball program.
Think about that. Bob Harris got to be your Yoda to you being Luke Skywalker.
and the thing is with that, if I'm not mistaken, if I'm not mistaken, you work with John Roth for both football, who's game day host for football, and you're color analyst for basketball. And he's been doing color analyst for basketball for what, over 20 years, I guess? And with two,
for sure.
I think if I'm right, what, only two announcers he's worked with? Bob and you. I'm right.
That's exactly right. And John Roth is obviously, for those that don't know, he is an institution around here with, you know, obviously went to Duke, but started his career, worked in media a little bit, but also worked on the communication side of things in the sports information director's office, and was actually Coach K's first SID back in the 80s. I don't know if a lot of people know that, but John Roth wrote a book, The Encyclopedia of Duke Basketball. And in addition, doing pregame hosting duties for our football broadcast, he also works on the sidelines and is there side by side with me for all the basketball games. So it's a treat to work with Rother as well. But no, we're not a huge group. We're a tight knit group though. And as you said, John Roth has been around for quite a while and worked with both Bob and I.
And you know what's so interesting about that though? It's like the way you and, you know, John deal with the football and basketball squads. How good do you think that we haven't started, you know, Shire in his third or fourth year yet with Duke basketball. But I know the Final Four was limit last year. You just couldn't get to the final last year. But how good do you see both football and men's basketball for 25-26?
No, and it's a great way to kind of wrap it up as I head out. I do think football is going to be really good. I mean, I don't want to get too deep into the 2D, for lack of a terminology, but you've got some really talented players on there. Chandler Rivers is All-American caliber player at corner. Darian Mensah mentioned earlier, the quarterback comes over from Tulane. Mm-hmm. A bunch of returners along the offensive line, some nice skill pieces at receiver, and obviously the defense is going to be elite. So I think this is a team that has a chance to get to Charlotte to play for an ACC title. And then just briefly, because you asked about it, I have a chance to see a couple workouts for the basketball program. And I think because of everything that came with last year and Cooper Flagg being such a generational talent, that maybe this group isn't getting quite as much attention as they probably should over the course of the summer. Cause I think the Boozer twins look really, really good. Dame Saar that comes over as an international player, I think is going to be a really good piece. And Duke returns a lot of guys inside. I mean, Malik Brown, the transfer from Syracuse, going into a second season, he's going to be healthy. I think Gungba's going to have a good year, and I think it's no small thing that Caleb Foster and Isaiah Evans are returning on the perimeter as well. The size and length still stands out, and I think defensively Duke is going to be really good and has all the pieces you want offensively. It's going to look a little different for sure with some of the guys that have gone off to the NBA, but obviously Josh Shire, as you mentioned, this is going to be his fourth season. I think they have every expectation for being one of the best teams in the country again, and that's a credit to him and his staff and the team that they put together. Cam Boozer is special. I think it's going to be fun to watch this year.
Oh boy. The Boozer twins, huh? Take you back to the 90s with Carlos and then Sheldon after that.
For sure.
They have a chance to be special.
Well, David, I'm just wondering if you have a final word. I know you have to leave, but we don't want to keep you, but we certainly appreciate you spending time with us on our program today. So if you have any final thoughts, you're welcome to tell us about them.
No, always a treat. Thanks for having me on. I don't know if I answered any questions about the state of college sports, but it feels like it's kind of up in the air and everyone kind of has their opinion right now. But it's an interesting debate, one I think we're going to be having for years to come. But I love this time of year because the games are starting, and that's why we love college sports and we can get back into it. And as you said, it's hard to believe, but 2 weeks from Thursday, we'll be kicking off here at Wallace Wade Stadium, getting football underway, and I can't wait to get started.
Unbelievable. Well, thank you very much, David Shoemate, for taking the time to be with us again here on Sports Roundtable, and we look forward to having you back again in the near future.
Thanks, everybody. Have a great afternoon.
You too.
Thank you.
I do want to go back to Rick from Florida, because while he was talking to David, he mentioned that he had some baseball thoughts, and I did want to get to baseball, especially where history was made this weekend. I'll get to that in a minute. There's a hint. Rick, you can come back with your baseball thought right now if you want to. You may have to raise your hand. I'm not sure if you did that yet or not again. Trish, is his hand raised?
No. Rick, go ahead, Rick.
He was on a few minutes ago, and he said he had some baseball thoughts.
Yeah, he's still here. Rick, you need to unmute. Yeah, he's muted. Let me send him.
Just to let everybody know, you're listening to Sports Roundtable, and we had David Shoemate, voice of the Duke Blue Devils, with us.
Hey, Bob, think about this for a second.
Yes, go ahead.
Because, Don, you and I were talking about this in text chain a little bit yesterday and this morning about a possibility that both the Mets and the Yankees may not. Is there going to be a scenario where both the Mets and Yankees don't make postseason, period? And I'm thinking there's definitely a possibility of it.
I think the Yankees will squeak in.
But the Mets are only, the third wild card is all of a sudden down to the Archie Bell and the Droz and the Titan up, as the Cardinals are only 3.5 games out of it. And they could be within 3 if they beat the Rockies. And I don't know if the Rockies are throwing Dolander tonight or not. I don't know, because they could switch that.
Which reminds me, Bob, I want to sarcastically thank your Red Sox for losing 2 out of 3 to the Padres. I
thought you'd want us to win.
I did want you to win. I wanted you to sweep them. That's why I say it was a sarcastic thank you.
Sarcastic golf clap.
Yeah, it didn't do us any favors. Not that we're doing us any favors with
you're not doing yourselves any favors.
No.
Didn't you guys lose 2 out of 3 to Toronto over the weekend?
Yesterday was terrible. 14 walks, left 16 guys on base, and gave up 3 home runs in the final 2 innings. The Dodgers really don't have a closer right now, and I
and that that's what I thought with the Dodgers, their biggest downfall was going to be.
The Dodgers don't have a closer. The Dodgers don't have a closer, but San Diego's got about five.
Well, the Padres have about four or five. The Yankees have three, and yet they can't get the ball to them.
Well, Devin Williams is having a horrible time right now.
Devin Williams, he's kind of cratered. He's kind of cratered. He really has. I mean, I'm sorry to say that about him.
That whole team is cratered. They're already making their plans for October for their tee times.
Well, here, like you and I talked about in text chain, if the Yankees get in and get bounced in the wild card, Aaron Boone, who was the worst, you know, manager of tactician I can remember for the Yankees.
Yeah, the worst we've had since Stump Merrill back in 1990.
I thought Buck Martinez was pretty bad,
Buck Showalter, he was good.
Well,
he was all right.
I think you're done for because we took two out of three.
You guys took two out of three, and you guys still have like a four game lead over Seattle or something like that. Either four
or five. It fluctuates.
Yeah, talking about Houston. You're talking about Houston. Yeah, we got you tonight.
Yeah, that's right.
Unless the Astros do something totally crazy, they're going to win that AL West for like the ninth year in a row. They're kind of becoming the Kansas City Chiefs of baseball, of the AL West.
I'm going to make a bold prediction on this show right now. Okay. Seattle is going to pass Houston.
Oh, I'd love to see that happen.
If that happens, it could.
We're getting some pitching back.
I'm going to jump in here really quick because Rick does have his hand up, and he is unmuted. So, Rick?
Rick, go ahead with your baseball thought.
Okay, guys. I'm sorry. I had to step out of the room for a minute. Here's the deal. My Mets, if they were on a table and somebody poured ice on that table, they completely slipped off of the table because I think they've lost
29 out of their last 59 or something like that?
Something like that.
I'm glad you brought that up because I listened to some guy on, you know, before Giants pregame, before they played the Bills. And this guy was like, said the Mets were like 20 something and 30 in their last 50 something games, while somebody was saying the Yankees were like something something and something something.
Yeah.
Two teams combined for like 30 something wins and almost 60 losses combined.
They both had a great start until about mid-May. And then after mid-May, they both tanked.
Here's what I'm thinking. I'm like, how in the world is the Reds, my Cardinals, Fishies, and a bunch of other teams still in this wild card? I'm like, oh wait, I forgot. The Mets find a way to shook like they normally do.
Yeah. I mean,
even their closer yesterday.
Awful.
Edwin Diaz.
Diaz.
It could never have gotten to him. They were head for nothing on the
ball. No.
But they didn't hold it.
And then all of a sudden. No, they couldn't
hold it.
And then all of a sudden it's like, it was 5-3, then it was 6-3 or something like that. And then Milwaukee ties the game and wins it at the bottom. I'm like,
yeah,
Milwaukee is going.
Their bullpen completely.
The crater.
Milwaukee's going nuts right now.
Well, here's the thing.
Milwaukee's going crazy.
Here's the thing, though.
Milwaukee and the Padres are the best two teams in the National League. And along the lines of your bold prediction, Bob, the Dodgers have lost 18 out of 30.
I forgot about them.
I believe that by Sunday, because we play three against the Angels down in Anaheim.
If you don't win that series, Mitch.
Well, we lost three to them up here a few months ago, but we got the Padres this weekend and the Padres next weekend.
Whoa.
And I really think there's a pretty good chance that we will be tied or out of first place, if not by this weekend and by the following weekend.
Well, the only saving grace for you, Mitch, is you have such a fat enough record where even if you don't win the division, you'll host a wild card game.
I'll tell you what. We're gonna get into the wild card in the playoffs.
But I really think the two best teams in the National League are Milwaukee and San Diego.
But here's the thing though. Just because they're doing well in the regular season, as we've always talked about with all sports, once you get to that second season, it don't matter. You start all the way back over.
The Padres did a fabulous job at the trade.
Oh, yes, they did.
They did the most of anybody, and they were really good at it.
Bob, Milwaukee did theirs before the deadline, and Milwaukee has been strong ever since. And they made some small little pickups here and there, but Milwaukee has been flat out getting it done.
Luther, have you heard of the Polish power? Is coming back.
I hope he didn't blow up his elbow. I think I heard something. They had him, I think, on 15-day IL, but I think they may have had to extend it out, but I think he's going to have to come back down for at least one or two rehab starts. That's what I'm thinking. If, you know, either he's going to go out to the Timber Rattlers, because the Sounds are in Durham this week, Tuesday through Sunday, and the Sounds, good Lord. Last night was the first time in their history they have been swept in the six-game format since the six-game set came into vogue in 2021. And that happened last night against the Jumbo Shrimp.
I wanted to get into the history that was made this weekend, the female umpire in Major League Baseball.
So neat.
Let me tell you. Jen Paul, because I think I told you this, Don, in text chain, that Jen Paul, I have heard a few broadcasts where she's been the either on base or behind home plate. Very consistent with what she does. Maybe one or two games she was not. But for the most part, she is very good at what she does. Very good.
For her.
I'm proud of her. I'm glad for her.
And from what little I've been able to find out, she was the kind of umpire you like, the kind of umpire that nobody noticed.
Yeah, exactly. And look,
she didn't jam herself into the game, you know, and try to make a show of herself, which is good. You don't want a Cowboy Joe West. We already had one of those.
Right.
Did she call the plate yesterday?
She was at the plate, yes.
Yeah.
Yeah, exactly. And
Given the state of umpiring in the major leagues these days, she's got to be an improvement.
The only game I can give her bad marks on was the Labor Day, was the game on that Monday night in Indianapolis where it just felt like nothing went well for either pitcher because the strike zone was tight and I think it was not a good night at all. On either side.
So she was a minor league umpire at one time.
Yes. She was in the last place where she got the call up. She was in the International League and she did a lot of Sounds games.
I mean, don't they have to move up like ball?
She's one of, if I'm not mistaken, 17 umpires who are on a list that can pinch hit. For one of the MLB umpires. So she can.
Yeah, I read that somewhere.
She can get called up to pinch hit for one of the umpires in the crew.
But it's like broadcasters. There's very few turning over. There's very few retiring, you know, like broadcasters.
Tim Grubbs got the call up in short relief. A couple of weekends ago for the Twins, who's the AA Warriors of the Wichita Wind Surge, and our buddy and pal Capper filled in for him.
Yeah. Talking about broadcasters, can I mention something?
Sure.
Okay. A few weeks ago, I was listening to, when the Mets played, the Yankees. It was a Mets-Yankee game. And I just wanted to see, I went on Fox, on the radio broadcast.
Yeah.
Terrible. I mean, they missed balls, strikes. I had no idea what was going on.
Okay, was it the National Feed or was it one of the?
I think
if
it was
you're
the
talking
National
Fox. That's TV.
That's TV.
Okay.
Because more often than not, now if the Mets were home that weekend, you would have listened to Howie Rhodes. If it were the Yankees, okay, you would have gotten Dave Sims. Either way.
No, they were home, but oh. I just wanted to check. And I think it was on Sirius oh. FM.
Then you probably would have gotten
the ESPN feed. If
ESPN feed, and I think
those guys aren't too good. They did the All-Star game.
Terrible.
Well, okay. I'm going to tell you, Mike Cousins is awful. I'm sorry. John Buchambi, awesome. Even though he's kind of getting a little bit up there a little bit, because I think he's doing more TV with the Cubs than a few other teams now.
Okay.
But John Buchambi on radio,
along those lines, there will be a positive, not just for Yankees fans, but if Aaron Boone gets fired, he was so much better as a color man on ESPN Sunday night games than Doug Glanville. Aaron Boone was tremendous.
Well, okay. Alex Rodriguez and Jessica Mendoza with John Buchambi when they had the three-man booth for the World Series last year.
She's good too. She did.
Jessica Mendoza is awesome.
A couple years back, she's very good.
Jessica Mendoza is awesome. Right.
Aaron needs to go back to ESPN. Aaron needs to come back to ESPN.
But they haven't fired him yet. When are they gonna?
That's my question.
I'm afraid he'll last as long as Connie Mack did. Because they have had their chances to fire him.
If Mr. Torrey would accept a Yankee contract, Joe Torrey wouldn't allow this. Joe Torrey would not allow this.
No.
Because Joe Torrey, he would know who to keep and who to send bye-bye quickly.
Yeah. But my point is that as soon as I switched back to the Met broadcast, I mean, it was like...
It was a night and day difference.
It was like night and day, exactly.
Well, because
I'm listening to Howie Rhodes. Howie Rhodes is just, I mean, it's fantastic. What is he, 76 or 78?
Something like that. Dave Sims isn't that bad either.
No.
I mean, Dave Sims doesn't suck either. I mean, even though he was a TV voice for the Mariners when he did radio on occasion, I'm like, why can't they have him do more radio?
Yeah.
And I'm glad.
A new balls and strikes. As a blind person, it was the way
a broadcast is supposed to sound.
Yes, exactly. Exactly.
Not trying to complain here, but hey, if I don't know balls and strikes, fair or foul, like, cause I hear this in the STAA group all the time that they talk about when they have like, you know, broadcasters and they forget to tell you, you know, who's where.
Oh, God.
And I'm like, come on. Where did you learn how to broadcast?
It's like Will Fleming, and I like Will Fleming as a Red Sox.
Oh, yeah. I know where you're going.
Here's something that he does that drives me nuts though, Luther, and Rick and everybody else. He doesn't seem to want to give the players batting averages their first time up.
Well, he should do that anyway.
Most of the time he doesn't. Mike Monaco, his partner does.
John Miller and Dave Fleming, on the other hand, on the Giants broadcast, phenomenal. Phenomenal.
Yeah.
And some younger guys who are good. Joe Block in Pittsburgh. Jack McMullen in Miami.
Jack McMullen's fantastic.
Jack McMullen, I was ready not to like him,
but because he replaced Kyle Seeloff, who I thought was great.
Kyle Seeloff, they moved him to TV to get rid of Greg Hammond.
I know, I'm trying to think who was on the
MLB network who used to do it. They finally canned him and moved into TV. And I'm like, why? Why are you wasting, why are you wasting this man's talent?
Yeah.
But McMullen's a good replacement.
Now McMullen, I remember him when he was doing the Indianapolis Indians with the legendary, Howard Kelman. Mm-hmm. And I think he did Ball State as well. That's where he got the chops to do the Indians, because he was doing Ball State.
We have about 3 or 4 more minutes to go. I do want to ask Trish at this time if there are any other hands raised while we have time to take another caller.
We are still all clear.
All right. Thank you.
And I
have an off the wall Luther question. I think this is a question Luther
would
respond to. I read an article yesterday about a league that I didn't even know existed, the Women's Professional Hockey League. And there was an article about
I've heard about them.
I've heard about it, but I've not really had a chance to look into it.
Yeah, there was an issue about their draft rules, and I was thinking, well, their draft rules have to be different because I don't know of a lot of colleges that have women's hockey teams.
I think Wisconsin Whitewater does. I think the University of Wisconsin does. But after that, I think BC might, and I think Hartford might.
I think
you might be right, but I know it's not a lot of
the only woman hockey player I'd ever heard of was Tony Granato's sister Cammy.
Yeah, I remember the
women's team years ago to a gold medal, but I didn't even know there was a professional women's hockey league.
Yeah, I mean, because there's a lot of stuff that keeps popping up a lot. So, you know how that goes.
There's supposed to be a women's professional baseball league as in a league of their own next year.
Really?
I just heard.
Yeah, I think that's what the MLB thing, isn't it?
I don't know. I didn't hear any details.
Cause I saw something along those lines on the At Bat app, if I'm not mistaken, but I can't remember exactly.
You got hockey and basketball and baseball covered for the women. All we need now is football.
There are a few leagues that have come and went, right?
They're doing big time flag football right now.
Yeah, flag.
Oh, there you go. Flag football.
Yeah.
Yeah, they're doing a lot
of flag. Yeah.
Yeah, we got teams here.
I think we got teams in Tennessee as well. For flag, men's and women's and high school as well. I mean, they've now with the TSSAA, they've put flag football as part of their, you know, their during the fall football, either the fall or the spring.
Well, it looks like our time is up for this edition of Sports Roundtable. I want to thank all of you for participating. David Shoemate, thank you again for being with us. We hope to have you back in the near future. Good luck with your Blue Devils and other aspects of your career as a radio host. Thank you, everyone. Go safe with God's abundant blessing. We will talk next week on Sports Roundtable.